Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Friday, October 3rd. I'm Sigurd Bjørn, reporting for KMUT. In tonight's news, a man involved in the Arcata City Council weapons scare is arrested again. Sequoia Park Zoo gets ready for a new black bear cub and advertises for conservation grant applications. Memorial for activist Robert Sutherland set for tomorrow in Bryceland. Those stories and more, including Ray Hamill's sports report, coming up. Shane Scott Hogan, who was the subject of a news report here on KMUT 2 days ago, is in the news again. You may recall that Hogan was arrested after approaching Arcata City Council members during a public meeting last month with a knife, a pepper spray, and what turned out to be a toy gun. Hogan was subsequently arrested and then released on bail. He is now back in county jail after being arrested for burglary at a Cal Poly property in Samoa. According to campus police, Hogan, who has been dwelling at the encampment in Arcata known as the 40, was discovered barricaded inside a storage space at the facility at 3 a.m. in the morning. Apparently, he refused to come out, and it wasn't until 6 hours later that officers were able to take him into custody. Hogan is now facing 6 new charges on top of the 6 he's already facing for the city council incident. His previous bail, which was paid, was set at $1,000, but the new bail amount is $55,000, which means Hogan may stay at the county correctional facility until his scheduled trial on November 17. Of course, if there are fresh developments in the case, KMUT will bring them to you. Staying on the local crime watch, if you will, Susan Anderson Drum of Fort Collins, Colorado, was arrested yesterday by county deputies after they responded to an incident on Quarry Road in Trinidad, where Anderson Drum allegedly fired a gun inside a residence. The woman was taken into custody and booked on 4 charges, including an assault with a firearm. We'll have updated news on the federal shutdown a little later in the newscast, but first we have a few local and state items to bring to you. The Sequoia Park Zoo's Conservation Council is accepting proposals for their 14th annual conservation grant program. Proposals must have a clear, measurable impact on the conservation of wildlife habitats. Special consideration will be given to projects that are in line with the Sequoia Park Zoo's mission, focusing on species represented at the zoo or support local wildlife or habitats. To learn more about the program and the zoo in general, we spoke to its director, Jim Campbell-Spickler.
Each year, the Sequoia Park Zoo and our Conservation Council offers to our community and actually anybody who applies the opportunity to receive a conservation grant. We've been doing this since 2012. And during that time, we have given out over $85,000 in support. And we started out small. The first couple years, we gave 1 to 2 small $1,000 grants. But recently, we've been able to up our game a bit. And now we're offering multiple awards for research up to $3,000. So we're very excited about this opportunity, and this is all made possible due to the generosity of the City of Eureka, which takes 50 cents from each ticket that we sell, and they put it into our field conservation program. Our conservation grants at the Sequoia Park Zoo, they're very popular. Last year, we had over 80 applicants, and because of this popularity, we've initiated a pre-proposal process to help us just get through all of these amazing grants that we're getting. So this year, we're accepting our pre-proposals from October 1st to November 3rd. And we then will review those pre-proposals. And if your application gets accepted, we're going to invite you to submit a full proposal, which will be due in early January.
The Conservation Grant Program is accepting proposals from all over the globe and in the past has given grants to projects relating to endangered and vulnerable species around the world, such as the Iberian Lynx in southern Spain and restoring forest corridors in Nicaragua for the critically endangered black-handed spider monkey. This year, the Grant Foundation will still consider international projects, but the focus will be heavily local.
Definitely the ones that fit into the zoo's conservation mission, and especially if they have something to do with one of our mission-focused species, like an animal that we have at the zoo. We just really want to try to keep this close to home every year. We're just blown away by some of the research ideas and this conservation ideas that are out there. Just last year, we supported work from a student out of Cal Poly looking at sunflower sea stars. Also in the past, Oregon silver spot butterflies.
The zoo is also involved in the Northern California Condor Restoration Program, where the zoo staffs a treatment facility it built for rehabilitating any sick, injured, or orphaned condors. The Sequoia Park Zoo has a long history, longer than most zoos. In fact, it's the oldest of its kind in California.
The zoo got started in 1907. Not only are we the oldest zoo in California, we're also one of the smallest accredited zoos in the nation. So we sit on 6.5 acres. It's a beautiful campus. But the thing that we're really known for is our coast redwood trees and our redwood skywalk. And the fact that we sit next to the Sequoia Park, which is a 70-acre, just beautiful piece of redwood forest. It also happens to be the tallest municipal forest on the planet. This is a city park that all of Eureka can come and enjoy. And we're just blessed to be in this location.
The Redwood Skywalk, a quarter-mile-long suspended bridge connecting old and second-growth trees, 100 feet above the ground, has been a huge boon for the zoo.
Yeah, the Redwood Skywalk was opened just about 5 years ago. And since then, we've more than doubled, nearly tripled, the number of annual visitors that we have come to the zoo. It was opened just about 5 years ago. And since then, we've more than doubled, nearly tripled, the number of annual visitors that we have come to the zoo.
With fall season just about to kick into gear on the North Coast, the zoo is getting ready to introduce new friends to the public.
So we recently welcomed several additions to our zoo family. We have now 6 spider monkeys. We started with 2, but we're welcomed 4 new additions. Also, a brand new North American porcupine whose name is Ozzy. He's with us now. He's going through his mandatory quarantine period, and soon he's going to be an ambassador animal for us, so folks will get to meet him. We've also recently welcomed Naboo, who is a black bear. He's a young guy, like about 18 months old, and he's behind the scenes in his quarantine period, but pretty soon he's going to be visible to our visitors.
Naboo was placed at the zoo by the California Department of Fish and Wildlife after recovering from multiple critical conditions which led to his rescue in the first place. The young cub's arrival ups the black bear population count at the zoo to 3, with Thule and Ishung already in place.
Our red panda habitat is just about to reopen. It's been closed for several months as we completed a renovation. And we also have a brand new red panda called Saffron, and he is going to be on exhibits sometime during the last week of October. That's the plan.
The Sequoia Park Zoo is open Tuesday to Sunday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., with last entry at 4:30 p.m. For conservation grant applications, go to the zoo's website, redwoodzoo.org/conservation. Tomorrow, October 4th, a memorial is being held at the Beginnings Octagon in Briceland for local environmental activist Robert Woods Sutherland, who was the co-founder of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center in Arcata. Nat Cardos reports.
On October 4th at Beginnings Octagon in Briceland, a memorial potluck will be held in memory of local activist Robert Wood Sutherland, also known as the Man Who Walks in the Woods, who passed away earlier this year on August 21st. Sutherland was largely known for his work with co-founding the Environmental Protection Information Center, EPIC, with Ruth Ann Cecil, and also filing over 50 lawsuits against Pacific Lumber back in the 80s. KMUN News spoke with Daryl Cherney, local environmental activist and colleague of Sutherland's, for more on the kind of work he did.
Well, I literally was brought here by a guy I picked up, Kingfisher, Native American Cheyenne, and he brought me right to the EPIC office. He asked me what I wanted out of life, and I told Kingfisher I wanted to live off the land and save the world, and he told me, you should go to Garberville. And he brought me right into the EPIC office, that's the Environmental Protection Information Center, and there I met Woods, Robert Sutherland, the man who walks in the woods, along with a bunch of other fantastic, legendary activists who live here in Southern Humboldt. So when I arrived here in November of 1985, I looked at the newspapers and saw that the Maxam Corporation had taken over Pacific Lumber Company and was going to double the logging of the world's largest private holder of ancient redwood trees. And I was shocked. When I got here from New York, I thought it would be illegal to cut down a 2,000-year-old tree or a 1,000-year-old tree. But I was wrong. So I knew immediately that Kingfisher had brought me to the right place. And so I started talking to people about how can we save these redwoods? And it was Woods, Robert Sutherland, who got together with me. And he, being the genius that he is, started to craft the first lawsuits against the Pacific Lumber Company that had been taken over by Maxam based on violations of the Forest Practices Act and the California Environmental Quality Act to stop, to shut down the logging of ancient trees. And so meeting Woods and having him fulfill, you know, that dream of trying to stop Pacific Lumber from cutting down the redwoods in the way that they were was my first encounter with him. And from that first lawsuit that Woods drafted, along with our lawyers, Jay Moeller and Tom Lippe and so many other great attorneys, EPIC filed another 50 or 55 lawsuits to protect our ancient redwood forests from slaughter from Pacific Lumber Company. So that was my first experience with Woods. And it was, you know, really amazing. Woods also in 1990 created the draft of the Forest Forever Initiative. And quite a number of us were involved in that, including Judy Barry and myself. And Woods, you know, drafted an entire state ballot initiative, Proposition 130, which we dubbed Forest Forever. And that was put in the state ballot and voted on by 30 million people. Sadly, that initiative lost by just one percentage point. It was a really bad year for initiatives. There was like 30 or 35 of them on the ballot, and almost all of them lost badly, except ours only lost by 1 point, which was really tragic. But Woods's genius was what created that really thousands and thousands of words that were there to protect the forest, which included expanding stream protection zones so our salmon and other aquatic wildlife can live. It banned clear cutting. It protected marble murrelet and other endangered aviary habitat. And so that was Woods. He was a force to be reckoned with. He was a writer. He was a thinker. And he perhaps as he was a legal monster. And he also understood the laws. He understood regulations. He understood the weak spots. He understood the parts that we could sue on. And so in that respect, he was truly a hero. Before I even got here, however, he had founded, or co-founded with Ruth Ann Cecil, the Environmental Protection Information Center back in 1978 to stop pesticide spraying, herbicide spraying of our forests, because the timber companies were spraying tan oaks and other what they called weed trees that they felt were preventing the growth of marketable timber like Douglas fir and redwoods. So Woods actually started in so many ways this environmental movement here in Southern Humboldt County that continues on to this day.
The memorial will be held from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m., where people can come see archival footage of Sutherland speaking, testimonials from the public, live music, and a potluck.
So we'll be gathering at Beginnings this coming Saturday, like just right up the pike here from 2 o'clock to 6 o'clock at the Octagon, and his family will be there. There'll be opening music by Jeannie and Jesse as people come in to warm up. There'll be a little table, or maybe more than a table, with some memorabilia from Woods. There'll be a little video archive and a television off in the corner that'll be on a loop, so that if people want to see Woods speak some of his finest thoughts, they can do that. And then, of course, we'll have a circle where people will be invited, the public will be invited to speak and share their memories of Woods. Now, Woods was a controversial figure, and he made a lot of waves. But at the end of the day, this place is a far better county and a far better forest because of Robert Sutherland, the man who walks in the woods, his presence here.
They are seeking volunteers for this event. For volunteer information, the email is esp@asis.com.
Following the defunding of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, public and community radio stations all over the country have lost funding. That, of course, includes us here at KMUD, who are quite frankly reeling from the loss. We don't talk too much about this funding loss here on the news, but this report from New Mexico about stations in a similar position piqued our interest. Ross Brown has more.
New Mexico legislators are set to discuss how the state could help keep public broadcasting on the air at a special session on Wednesday. Nationwide, the Rescissions Act, signed by President Donald Trump, cut more than $1 billion from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The cuts put many rural outlets, including those that disseminate emergency information to tribal communities, at risk of closing. Rashad Mahmood with New Mexico's Local News Fund says the state lost almost $6 million distributed by CPB, a nonprofit organization created by Congress in 1967 to support public broadcasting.
A lot of our rural public media stations in New Mexico got very large percentages of their budget from the CPB. There are several tribal stations that got almost all of their funding from the CPB, essentially.
Mahmood says several New Mexico radio stations support their communities by translating programming into Navajo to serve the Navajo Nation, which spans across New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah. A lasting example is KTDB, founded in 1972, one of the country's first indigenous-owned and operated radio stations. In many rural parts of the state, public media is the only source of reliable local news, and Mahmood says some outlets aren't likely to stay afloat, even if local residents increase contributions.
If you're based near Albuquerque or Santa Fe, you have a wealthier population base to draw upon to support your work. But if you're serving lower-income parts of the state or rural parts of the state, how much money is it reasonable to expect that you would raise from the community that you serve?
The Knight Foundation and MacArthur Foundation, along with other philanthropies, pledged nearly $37 million in emergency funding in August to support public media stations facing closure due to federal funding cuts, but it's not known if that funding will be ongoing. I'm Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Now, here at KMUD, we are in the middle of a fund drive. And if you can at all help, we ask you to call our office at 707-923-2513 to donate. Or you can send us a direct donation through Venmo at KMUD Radio is our handle there. Just a reminder that KMUD is a non-profit, so your donation is tax deductible. A donation to us is kind of you deciding exactly where your tax dollars go. Before we switch fully over to the latest in the government shutdown, we have a related report from the Native News Network about how the shutdown will affect Indian health services across the nation. Here is Antonia Gonzalez.
The Indian Health Service is operating as business as usual during the federal government shutdown, which started Wednesday. The IHS says it has received advanced appropriations. Tribal leaders from across the country have been raising concerns about the shutdown. This week, President Thora Walsh Padilla of the Mescalero Apache tribe in New Mexico updated her community in a social media post, saying health services are operating normally, but says she's concerned about other federal programs, including Medicaid, food stamps, and Social Security, but assures the community the tribe continues its work.
Tribal leadership has conveyed our concerns to our federal representatives, and we are continually reaching out for updates as the federal budget is being developed. But please be assured, we will get through this together. Our tribe will still stand strong.
And here is Mike Clifford from the Public News Service with the latest on the shutdown.
Today marks day three of the government shutdown. NBC News reports the Senate will vote this afternoon on the Democratic and Republican short-term spending bills, which have failed to advance several times. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, said if the measures are blocked again, the Senate will adjourn until Monday, extending the government shutdown into a sixth day. NBC notes the majority of Trump supporters backed tax subsidies for Affordable Care Act plans, a new poll conducted in the days before the shutdown has found, an extension of Obamacare Medicare subsidies, which expire at the year's end, is a key sticking point for Democrats in the fight. Meantime, the government shutdown is getting attention, but farmers in South Dakota also wonder where things stand with agriculture programs now that the Farm Bill has expired.
Without new action, some critical programs will continue, but others are paused. Michael Happ of the Midwest-based Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy says Congress should know farmers are operating under a much different model than 2018, the last time a farm bill passed.
Input costs are through the roof. Corn prices in particular are way down. And then, yeah, we have the uncertainty from the tariffs.
Economists say tariffs were felt during President Donald Trump's first term, but now global customers like China are buying commodities from other nations. I'm Mike Moen.
And federal tax credits for electric vehicles and clean vehicle standards ended yesterday. Advocates say the end of the policies will put the U.S. at a disadvantage.
President Donald Trump signed his budget reconciliation bill in July, ending federal EV tax credits and fuel economy standards. EV sales represent 12% of cars sold in 2024, according to the Maryland Department of Transportation. The end of the tax credits may also pump the brakes on the state's plan to have all model year 2035 vehicles sold in the state be electric. Ingrid Malmgren with Plug-in America says there's been a concerted effort to ensure vehicles in the U.S. are run on gasoline or diesel.
There's been a lot of money spent in the 2024 election cycle by oil and gas interests, and this appears to be the administration and congressional leadership's way of paying back for all of those donations and funding.
Republican lawmakers and Trump have railed against EV tax credits. They argue the market should determine what vehicle consumers drive, rather than government incentives to prop up the industry. I'm Simone Perez.
The Democratic bill to temporarily fund the government that Mike Clifford mentioned at the start of the roundup was, as expected, voted down, 46 to 52. We're nearing the end of the news week here at KMUD, which means it's time for Ray Hamill at HumboldtSports.com to close us out.
Ferndale High football continued its blistering start to the new season with another huge win over the weekend as the Wildcats get set for their conference opener this week. Hello and welcome to this week's KMUD News Sports Report. I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com. We'll have more on the Wildcats and all of the latest high school football news from around Humboldt, Mendocino and Del Norte counties in just a moment as we take a look at all of the big local sports stories of the week, including why it was also a big week for the Ferndale High girls soccer team and all of this week's high school soccer news, some college football, some volleyball, some Cal Poly Humboldt Hall of Fame news, and why next week will be a big one in local cross country. But first up, the Ferndale Wildcats are showing no signs of slowing down as they get set to defend the Little Four football championship they shared with Arcata a year ago. Last weekend, the Cats improved to 4-0 on the season with a fourth straight shutout victory. Ferndale welcomed the Eureka Loggers to the Cream City and dominated on the way to a 58-0 win. Prescott Langer scored four touchdowns in the victory, while senior lineman Ethan Weitzel had another monster game in the trenches. Remarkably, the Cats have now outscored their first four opponents 226-0. The Ferndale players will try to carry that momentum into conference play this weekend as they get set to kick off the Little Four at Hoopa on Friday night. Saturday's loss was the third straight for the Loggers, who dropped to 1-3. Also in action last weekend, the Fortuna Huskies finally got their first win of the season and improved to 1-3 with a 35-0 win over University Prep at Husky Field. The South Fork Cubs also played and rallied from a two-touchdown deficit in the second half to beat Branson 40-28 and improve to 2-1, while Arcata fell 34-26 to Oakland and dropped to 1-3. And rounding out a busy weekend for the HDNL schools, the McKinleyville Panthers travelled to Cloverdale and came away with a 10-7 win over the Eagles. With the victory, the Panthers improved to 2-2 as they continue to put some distance between themselves and back-to-back winless seasons in 2023 and 2024. Hoopa, St. Bernard's and Del Norte all had byes last week, but all three will be back in action this weekend, as the Big Four and Little Four conferences both begin play. In addition to Ferndale's game at Hoopa, Friday night will also see South Fork play at Round Valley in the NCL 3 and Del Norte travel to Fortuna to take on the Huskies in the Big Four. The action continues on Saturday. St. Bernard's will host Eureka in an always highly anticipated Big Four showdown, while Arcata makes the short trip to play neighbor and rival McKinleyville in the Little Four. Some of the Mendocino County schools also were in action last weekend. Willits suffered its first loss of the season, falling 22-9 to Middletown and dropping to 3-1, while Fort Bragg enjoyed a second straight win, getting the better of Lower Lake 12-8 and improving to 2-3. The Wolverines will try to bounce back when they play at Lower Lake on Friday night, while Fort Bragg will play at Upper Lake, also on Friday night. The Ukiah Wildcats also were in action last week and lost for the second straight weekend, falling 42-14 at San Marin and dropping to 2-3. The Wildcats will have a bye this week before travelling to play Montgomery next weekend. In local college football, meanwhile, College of the Redwoods closed out its pre-conference schedule with another loss last Saturday. The Corsairs had 6 turnovers and fell 48-27 to Monterey Peninsula, dropping to 0-5. Sior has a bye this weekend before opening conference play at Sierra College next week. In local high school soccer, meanwhile, the Ferndale girls and Fortuna boys have been the stories of the season so far here on the North Coast. The Ferndale girls continued to roll this past week with a pair of impressive wins. On Saturday, the Cats travelled to Eureka and knocked off the four-time defending North Coast section champion Loggers 2-1. They followed that with a 5-0 win over South Fork in the Little Four on Tuesday, stretching their unbeaten run to 10 straight games. The Ferndale girls have not lost since their season opener against Kelseyville, and they have won 9 of their 10 games since then, including 7 by shutout. Also in girls' action this week, Eureka and Fortuna tied 0-0 on Tuesday to remain deadlocked atop the Big Four standings, while Arcata edged McKinleyville 2-1 to move within 1 point of the front runners. In the Little Four, Del Norte and St. Bernard's tied 1-1 in Eureka and are both tied for second in the standings, 3 points behind the high-flying Wildcats. The Fortuna boys, meanwhile, improved to 5-0 in the HDNL with a thrilling 5-4 win over Eureka on Wednesday night, with Danny Cortez scoring the winning goal just 2 minutes from time. The Huskies are the only perfect team in the HDNL, boys or girls, and are now 14-0 as they get set for a pivotal showdown at Arcata on Saturday to close out the first half of their league schedule. The Tigers are 4-0-1 in league play and sit just 1 point behind Fortuna in the standings. Saturday's big game kicks off at 3 p.m. Also in HDNL boys action this week, Del Norte won 5-1 at St. Bernard's on Tuesday and McKinleyville won 7-2 at South Fork on Wednesday. In local high school volleyball, the Eureka Loggers continued to roll on Tuesday night with a straight sets win over Fortuna to go to 3-0 in the Big Five, while Arcata won in straight sets at McKinleyville and improved to 3-1 halfway through their conference schedule. In Little Four volleyball, the St. Bernard's girls lead the standings with a record of 3-0 after a straight sets win over Hoopa on Tuesday, while Ferndale improved to 2-1 with a victory over South Fork. Switching gears, this weekend will be a big one for Cal Poly Humboldt Sports as the Jacks get set to induct the 2025 Hall of Fame class. A ceremony will take place on Friday night at Baywood Golf and Country Club, and this year's class includes legendary men's basketball player Fred Hux, who helped lead the Jacks to a Final Four appearance in 2004. And rounding out another busy week in local sports, the HDNL Cross Country Runners are gearing up for their season opener. The league action gets underway at the Eureka Municipal Golf Course next Wednesday afternoon, with the races starting at 4 p.m. And that's this week's KMUD News Sports Report. Until next time, I'm Ray Hamill with HumboldtSports.com.
That's it for the news this week. Nat Cardos will be back on Monday at 6 p.m. But for now, thanks to our engineer for delivering the news to you, and to our reporters Nat Cardos, Ross Brown, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Clifford, Mike Moen, Simone Perez, and Ray Hamill. My name is Sigurbjörn, and I thank you for listening.
KMED News is online. You can find us on kmed.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commute. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmed.org.